Thanks for joining A&M Conversation With, a podcast series featuring Alvarez and Marsal leaders discussing the trends impacting businesses today. In this edition of A&M Conversation With, David Gruber, A&M's Healthcare Industry Group Managing Director and Director of Research, sits down with Peter Abanowitz, Managing Director of the Regulatory and Compliance Practice and a former senior official at the Department of Health and Human Services under President Bush. This is the first in a two-part series to discuss the evolution of Trump Care as it moves forward, as well as identifying potential winners and losers in the healthcare ecosystem.
Thank you, Peter, for joining us today to discuss President-elect Trump's plan for healthcare reform and related issues. Peter Abanowitz runs our regulatory and compliance healthcare practice at Alvarez & Marsal and is a former senior-ranking official at the Department of Health and Human Services under President Bush, and as a result has unique perspective on what is likely to come forward. Peter, what are your thoughts on what you've seen?
Well, thanks, David. It's a very interesting time in any administration or about to be administration when you move from campaigning and campaign rhetoric to actually governing. And, it's just a change in tone, and it's an interesting change in perspective. And we view the candidates and now president-elect very differently than we viewed him as a candidate. So the interesting thing about this administration is it's been tradition for, going back over 30 years for candidates to have campaign books. Bill Clinton had a famous one in 1992, Putting People First. George W. Bush had one in 2000. Barack Obama had a very best-selling one, The Audacity of Hope. And Hillary Clinton had one, too. Donald Trump did not have that traditional campaign biography or a prescriptive policy book. And granted, those books there's a lot of fluff in it. It builds up the candidate, and it's from their perspective. But there are glimpses in there of how they might govern, what kind of actual policies they will put into place. So left without that, we're left with two things to figure out what's going to happen in the Trump administration with respect to healthcare. One is, what did he say on the campaign trail? Well, one thing that he said over and over and over again, and he since said it in interviews since being elected president, is he is going to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as it's colloquially known. That's a promise he's going to have to keep. In one form, fashion, or another, Obamacare will be repealed, and it will be replaced with something else. Now, the big question is, what is it going to be replaced with? What does it look like? The second thing that we have to look to is, who does he surround himself with? The personnel that a president puts into places in the executive branch is a key, probably I think even more so than policy books and papers, is the most important sign of what the president thinks. There's a old phrase from the Reagan administration, personnel is policy. Essentially means who you put in certain positions says what you think should happen or what your policy should be. So the other thing I think we got to do is we have to look closely at the people that President-elect Trump is putting into these healthcare policy positions.
So we have three potential plans. We have Trump Care, as described on its website, 310 words. We have Dr. Price's plan and the Act, which was once withdrawn from Congress and then resubmitted in 2015. We also have Paul Ryan, and we can't forget his influence in the process. So how does the troika of these three folks come together, and what's the process, what's the timeline, and what do you think comes out at the other end?
But there are two things here. One, what you have on the transition website is consistent with what was said on the campaign trail. Primary among that is repealing Obamacare, replacing it with something, and then some additives to that, health savings accounts, promoting health savings accounts, promoting sales of insurance products across state lines, so less authority to state insurance commissioners, more to insurance companies to sell their products everywhere, the establishment of high-risk pools. So, he's given some, the president-elect, Trump, has given some very broad views on what he thinks should be in a package, but he hasn't written anything. So he's obviously going to defer a lot of that to Congress. And you have two people, One, the speaker, Paul Ryan, who has been very involved in healthcare and thinking about healthcare since his time as House Budget Chairman and then House Ways and Means Chairman and now as Speaker of the House. So he's going to have a lot to say about healthcare, and he has had a lot to say. He has his own plan called The Better Way. And then the other person who's going to have a lot to say is the person who is the Secretary Designate of Health and Human Services by President-elect Trump. That's Dr. Tom Price. So Dr. Price was the chairman of the House Budget Committee. He wrote, as you noted, he wrote his own repeal and replace legislation in May of this year. So he's already got a playbook himself for how he thinks this bill or this law should be replaced. So I think all three of them come together, and I think, my view, Dr. Price takes a lead role with the Speaker's office in coming up with the legislative package, which I think is going to come very quickly. Unlike the Affordable Care Act, which stretched on well almost into 2 years with House hearings and Senate hearings and bills on the House side and bills on the Senate side, I think that they come out of the box on a very organized basis with a quick package in maybe as early as February on what they're going to do.
So coverage is a sticky issue. We have 11 million people who have coverage through health exchanges. We have another 15 million people who gain coverage through Medicaid. Obamacare was about coverage, but it wasn't about cost containment. The piece of Obamacare that people have to focus in on is access and affordability. So although coverage was provided, the affordability got worse, not better. And that includes folks on health exchanges, where we saw this year premiums going up 22%. But that's a figure that excludes the out-of-pocket maximum, which for the individual is $7,150, and for a family is $14,300. So the first issue, Peter, can you comment on is coverage, and how do we deal with that politically messy issue?
Look, how do you deal with something on taking away coverage? That's going to be the first challenge that this administration has. You've got millions of people who are now covered by Medicaid expansion. You have millions of people who are covered on these exchange products. How are you going to provide coverage to them if you take care of the exchange, take away the exchanges, if you take away Medicaid expansion? You're going to have to create some kind of vehicles for them, and you're going to have to create some kind of subsidies for them, whether it's direct payment through the exchanges is currently happening, or a tax credit, a refundable tax credit. You're going to have to provide some money for those people to continue to buy insurance, or you're going to be faced with a real problem of people who were covered. Many of them were Trump voters. They were covered. And if a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now, they're not covered, they're going to be unhappy.
So let's discuss the winners and losers. And since we're on the topic of the individual, are they going to be winners and losers looking forward?
Depends who the individual are. If you're an individual and you're not getting a subsidy right now, and let's say you're 28 years old, and there are only expensive policies out there for you, this might be good for you, because we're going to go back to a time where insurance companies are going to offer more products and possibly offer you a product as a 28-year-old, 29-year-old, which is going to be much more affordable to you. So that's you may be a winner. People we don't know whether they're going to be on the losing side or not is what happens to the people who are getting significant subsidies right now that are covering most of the cost of coverage. What happens to them? What happens to the people who are in the expanded Medicaid population? Does funding for them go away, or does it stay through some kind of block grant funding from the federal government to the states? That's the unknown on individuals. Are they going to benefit, or are they going to lose out on this?
And so just to reiterate that 75% of U.S. households have incomes below $100,000. And so really what we're talking here is over 100 million Americans will be affected by this decision, and it's all about equity. I'd like to move next to the federal government, winner or loser.
Well, look, it's hard to tell on that one, particularly if, as you said, this repeal, replace doesn't deal with the cost issue. When I was at the department 16 years ago, the combined Medicare, Medicaid spend was around $600 billion a year. We're now at about $1 trillion a year in combined Medicare, Medicaid spend. And while the Affordable Care Act did a lot to expand coverage and, you know, cover about 20 million people, it really was not effective in changing the overall cost in the system. And that's something that's got to be addressed. And if that is not addressed, then the federal government's going to be the loser in here, and the taxpayers are going to be the losers, because we're going to have an increasing, much more increasing federal deficit if that Medicare, Medicaid spend continues to rise.
And I'd like to add to that, looking forward, a few numbers. In 2016, $3.4 trillion spend. The CMS forecasts total U.S. spend of $5.4 trillion in 2026. When you look at the federal deficit, that's forecast to rise to 105% of GDP come 2026. It's approximately 84% at the moment. The driver of the deficit are mandatory outlays, for which Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare account for the vast majority. So there's talk of entitlement reform, and the question is, where does the deficit fit going forward? The other thing I want to iterate is that cost containment, healthcare is grossly inefficient in the United States, and we do have benchmarks, and we're at 18.2% spend. You go to Europe, it's 10 to 12%. So we have 50 to 75% inefficiency. That inefficiency relates to waste. There are things we could do to redesign, and it really comes down to fundamental reform and fundamental payment reform, and we need to shift from fee-for-service to value, and the question is, what's going to happen there? Let's speak about states.
So, look, this could be a real winner for states. States in the sense that want to run their own Medicaid programs with less interference from Washington, from the federal government. This is a three perspectives, one president-elect, and then two, his secretary-designate, Dr. Tom Price, and his proposed administrator for CMS, Seema Verma. They are committed to giving more authority and more flexibility to the states to run their Medicaid programs and cover people the way that they think should be covered in their states, and, you know, decide how much is going to be paid to nursing homes, public hospitals, who should be covered, at what percentage. Right now, it's something of a one-size-fits-all in Medicaid. You can get some waivers, you can get some relief, but it's kind of one-size-fits-all. So I think what you're going to see out of this administration is, first of all, flexibility through Medicaid waivers. Let states design their programs in the way that they think works best for them. And two, the real possibility of Medicaid block grant funding, which has been talked about for years, talked about when I was in the Bush administration, and we were unable to do it. But really, instead of making it a matching program, just devolve that money, give a set amount of money based on a per capita basis to the state of New York, to the state of Texas, to the state of California, and say, Governor, it's up to you and your state legislature to figure out how to spend that money to cover the most people that you can.
But the fundamental question remains, you know, are states better than the federal government at managing local health care expenditures? In my own experiences, some states are better and some are worse in that regard. Any thoughts there?
Look, it depends where they decide to spend it and who's got power and influence at the state capitol, because that's where it'd be interesting. A lot of the decisions get made now in Washington, so that's where the lobbying presence is. As you start to devolve this money and flexibility to the states, there's going to be a lot more activity at 50 state capitals and some jostling around between hospitals and doctors and public hospitals and academic medical centers and home health and nursing homes. And they're all going to be jostling with each other for a fixed piece of the pie and say, you know, I want this amount, you know, and if I get this amount, you're going to get less. So we're going to see that playing out in 50 different states.
Hospitals, key part of the healthcare ecosystem, winner or loser?
Look, it's going to be tough for hospitals if we see more people who go uncovered. The one thing that the Affordable Care Act did do is increase coverage both by exchange products and by the Medicaid expansion. And so there were less uninsured people showing up in emergency rooms at hospitals. So that was good for them. Certainly even better for the states that had Medicaid expansion. As part of the covering more people, some of the other programs, a disproportionate share and the like, were cut back under the Affordable Care Act. Those are other programs that helped hospitals to deal with uninsured patients who show up in their emergency rooms and in their hospitals. So there's going to have to be some way to address that, or it's going to be very negative for acute care hospitals in any respect.
And what's important is to see in what states the hospitals participate. In the states where there's Medicaid expansion, they're obviously losers. In their states where there was no Medicaid expansion, they're potentially winners, because if the DSH payments are put back, and right now they're scheduled to be eliminated, then there'll be increased funding coming forward. So again, lots of complexity. Peter, I want to thank you for today. It was a terrific discussion. And our next podcast will focus in on the implications of the proposed changes to the individual sectors in great detail.
Thanks, David. Look forward to continuing the discussion.
For our listeners, for more information, visit our homepage at alvarezandmarsal.com and connect with us on LinkedIn at Alvarez and Marsal.